You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mireya Solis, Senior Fellow and Night Chair in Japan Studies. And on behalf of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies and the Project on International Order and Strategy, it is a pleasure to welcome you this morning to the program on Global Summitry in East Asia. But before I discuss the substance and the organization of the event, I want to express my condolences to the victims of the earthquakes in Japan and Ecuador. Our sympathy for the people who lost their lives, people who lost loved ones and their communities, their places of work were destroyed. Well, let me then move on and talk about the program for today. Every day, we're reminded how in an era of fluid geopolitics, fluid geoeconomics, challenges to the international order abound. From ever-morphing terrorism, massive refugee flows, a stubbornly sluggish world economy, and the specter of global pandemics. And so inevitably, the question arises, where will needed governance come from? Which nations and through which platforms will step up to the plate? Should it be the G7? Should it be the G20? Should they work together and try to coordinate in providing effective ways in dealing with these pressing challenges to the international order? The problems and the solutions, of course, are global. But the question of the role and effectiveness of leader summitry is of particular importance to East Asia in 2016. Why? Because this year, Japan and China, two economic giants, which sometimes are perceived as political rivals, will respectively host the G7 and the G20 summits. So we have prepared a program to address the following timely and important questions. And of course, we're going to invite all of you to share your opinions and have a conversation later on. But what are the questions guiding our program today? First and foremost, is global summitry effective in providing international governance? Second, with a focus on East Asia, how will China and Japan use their role as hosts to boost their leadership credentials and advance important priorities in their foreign policy strategies? And third, we're going to talk about the coexistence of the G7 and the G20. And the question here is, can the Asian hosts create synergies in the work they do? We know that there are areas of shared interest, restoring the health of the global economy, promoting development, promoting quality infrastructure. These are crisscrossing areas of interest. Should we expect, therefore, that there is effective coordination that can G7 and G20 work in tandem? Or can we expect the more familiar pattern of separate tracks and disparate efforts to take place? As you can see, I have given a lot of homework to our panelists in trying to address these very complex questions. But they're undaunted because they are true experts on these topics, and they have very kindly agreed to share their insights with us today. I will introduce them in the order in which I will ask them to come to the podium to offer their remarks, and then we'll move on to have a conversation with all of you. So first, my colleague and co-organizer of this event, Tom Wright, is fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy. And Tom works on a very broad set of strategic issues, such as the future of U.S. alliances, multilateral diplomacy, and U.S. relations with rising powers. Tom will discuss the role of leader summitry in international governance, and I think in particular G7. Yves Sivergin is director of the Institute for Asian Research and associate professor at the University of British Columbia. And Yves' research focuses on G20, global public goods, and climate change. Yves' regional expertise also runs very deep, and he's equally comfortable talking about Japan and China's economic foreign diplomacy. And so he has kindly agreed to talk about how these two Asian hosts may use the GE Summit to advance important foreign policy priorities. My other Brookings colleague, Colin Bradford, is a non-resident senior fellow at the Global Economy Program, and previously Colin was chief economist at USAID. His research areas are on global economic governance and international economics and development. Colin will discuss the short-term growth agenda and the long-term link to sustainable development goals. And I also want to announce a small change, a big change in the program. Nancy Alexander unfortunately cannot be here with us today. She had a personal emergency, and therefore she could not be here this morning with us. So that's all for me for now, and I would like to ask Tom to come to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. I'd like to thank you and to Jennifer as well for organizing this with us and for really doing the lion's share of the work. So we appreciate it. And I think it's going to be interesting. Looking forward to the conversation. I think we'll have a sort of unusually interesting year for G7 and G20. Summitry. There's very little, I think, that we can say with certainty, except maybe that Justin Trudeau will take the opportunity to steal the limelight yet again at an international summit or meeting, maybe by speaking Mandarin fluently to Xi Jinping in Beijing or Japanese to Prime Minister Abe. But what I wanted to talk about was really these upcoming summits, but mainly the G7 and really the different agendas of the two hosts and really what this sort of represents. Because Maria, I think, asked a very important question, which is what does this mean for global governance and what can we take from the both summits to understand how countries are tackling common challenges. And I might reframe it a little bit and say that these two summits really represent two very different sort of theories or models about how the world is going to work for the next 10 years. On the one hand, you have sort of the G20 summit, which I think represents ideas that have been pretty dominant over the last 10 or 15 years, which is that the challenges we face in common are more important than the things that divide us, and that the issues like climate change and infrastructure and growth and development and non-proliferation and counterterrorism, all of these challenges are ones that countries, major powers generally have in common, and that the most important thing is how they sort of react to that. And the challenge is really to have increased coordination and cooperation so you have more effective responses to these problems. And so you need to bring more countries into the tent, and you need to deepen sort of engagement and really sort of have sort of a transformation, an ongoing transformation of world politics. So that's sort of the G20 model. Obviously, the G20 at the leaders' level dates back to one of those greatest moments of common challenges in 2008 and 2009 with the financial crisis. But the second sort of view is that actually, while those challenges are quite important, that we are seeing the return of interstate competition, and we're seeing the return of competition between major powers. Some of it has an ideological dimension, and that actually you can't get very far by bringing countries together in large numbers, because you can't really talk about responding to Russia and Ukraine when you have Russia in the room, and you need to agree everything with Vladimir Putin, and similarly perhaps with China and the South China Sea, or from the Chinese and Russian perspective, maybe they have issues that they want to deal with Western powers, and that's complicated and by those large forums as well. And so that model is really that, while we need to continue to work on climate, we need to continue to work in the global economy, we also have to be attentive to the balance of power in East Asia, to Chinese activities in the South China Sea, to Russian activities in Europe, and that what you need, in Dean Acheson's famous words, is you need to build situations of strength amongst like-minded powers. You need to bring together democratic countries in Europe and Asia and North America to work together, and maybe other like-minded countries, maybe authoritarian countries, to work increasingly together to advance their agenda. So it is a more sort of divided world. And to me, that this sort of difference between the geopolitical and sort of the you know, the more sort of transnational global issues has been a tension. You see it in the Obama administration and even in the president's own words on foreign policy over the last 8 years. But this is really crystallizing this year in these two summits, because what we have in the forthcoming G7 summit is a host, Prime Minister Abe, who is, you know, he has his list of common challenges and said he wants it to focus on climate and infrastructure and health. And obviously there can be immediate crises infused into it, either in the Middle East or by North Korea. But really what he wants to focus on is East Asia. And what he wants to focus on is trying to convince other democracies that actually they too have a stake in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and they too have a stake in putting some pressure, you know, on China about territorial issues. He's put this on the agenda. We saw the communique last week or the week before from the G7 foreign ministers meeting in Hiroshima, which focused quite a lot on maritime, communique, and focused a lot on the South China Sea. And he's invited other countries from the region to attend. And I think the way the Prime Minister sees this issue is essentially he believes that the common sort of thread between what's happening there and European or America, well, America's a special role, but European and North American interests more generally is the rule of law. And that there is a commitment to multilateral resolution of territorial disputes and to certain processes that is sort of a unifying theme between Ukraine and the maritime disputes in East Asia. And he sees this as a way of trying to bring in or lock in European countries into having more influence or making this part of their agenda with China, because of course they've made their China agenda primarily around commercial and more sort of common political diplomatic issues rather than these more issues of conflict of interest. So that's where he sort of sees it. The US, I think, is broadly on board with that as a general matter. The US has certainly pushed, you know, Europe to take a more active role on the case that the Philippines has against China on the South China Sea, which is coming up for judgment in a couple of months. And the US has encouraged Europe to take a more active, holistic role in East Asia. But the problem is that this sort of agenda, of course, runs directly into the G20 and into China. China's reacted very angrily to the Prime Minister's focus on the South China Sea and maritime issues. And it's really been sending warning shots in the media, in the Chinese media and elsewhere, saying that this would damage bilateral relations between China and Japan. But one also suspects that it will complicate the G20's role as well. I don't think that there will be any sort of real change in path on this, because I think, as I was trying to say a minute ago, it really reflects fundamentally different visions about what's actually most important. And so for the Prime Minister, or even for many people in the United States, the issue is not that focusing on the South China Sea will disrupt other issues. It's that issue in and of itself merits greater attention sort of on the world stage. Now, there are a couple of sort of flies in the ointment, as it were. One is the Prime Minister's stated desire also to build bilateral ties with Russia. And so he has made it, although he's been very clear in condemning Ukraine and has certainly stood fast on sanctions against Russia, it's well known that he would like to see more bilateral relations, bilateral engagement with Moscow because of the unresolved issues in Japan's north over the northern territories. And it believes that there's a way to essentially engage Russia on common issues while disagreeing on Ukraine and while maintaining sanctions, much in the same way that the world sort of engages with China on common issues while disagreeing on specific issues. There has been strong pushback against that from the US, and certainly there is a lot of concern in Europe on it. The second sort of fly in the ointment, as it were, is the European sort of response. I think Europe will be reluctant to go along with sort of Abe's sort of vision of where the G7 should go, because they do have a very different view of China. And it's one, essentially, it's not that they think what's going on in the South China Sea is okay, it's that they would largely like to compartmentalize it or in one sort of section and then to focus on the other sort of common interests. And so they're more in the G20 sort of mindset. But at the same time, they are in a difficult position, I think, because the rule of law sort of issue, and particularly the case, the Philippines case, does sort of make it abundantly clear, really, that there are fundamental issues at stake here. And for Europe not to sort of back China, and not to back the Philippines on that case when the judgment comes out, or to back, sorry, the finding of the court, as opposed to the Philippines, I'm assuming here that it will be somewhat favorable to the Philippines. But even if it's not, even if it's more mixed, China doesn't recognize the authority of the court, of course. So for Europe, that raises a pretty fundamental issue of the rule of law. So I think that we will see a sort of clash at this, not a clash at the summit, but we see a clash between the summits to that extent, and we will see a lot of diplomacy between the European leaders, you know, and the Japanese in terms of trying to massage the issue or nuance it or ensure that it doesn't sort of take over the entire agenda. To me, what the sort of fundamental takeaway is that these geopolitical issues now have contagion effects, that they are now beginning to affect other types of cooperation, and that is, I think, not a surprise, and it's not something that's really reversible, because these are, until there's a fundamental change in world politics, because these are real issues. I mean, these are issues that Japan is and other countries are fundamentally concerned with, and they do rise to a higher level of importance in those countries than these transnational issues. When faced with a choice between sort of issues of fundamental geopolitical importance and, say, climate change, a country is going to go with the issues of fundamental geopolitical importance, even though climate is development are very important long-term issues. So we will see some contagion effects from these issues. I mean, we one only need to think back to a couple of years ago when the Malaysian airline went missing and East Asian nations found it very difficult to share radar data because they were worried about that being used against them by other countries because it would reveal their strengths and vulnerabilities. I mean, that was a very early sort of example of how global cooperation can be complicated by geopolitics. And more generally, and just to sort of conclude, I think when you look at the G7 summit, you see sort of different, I mean, these leaders, you know, fundamentally what makes a G7 summit different, I think, than the G20 or than larger forums is that it is a very small, informal gathering. And essentially, these leaders will talk about what they want to talk about, right? They're not bound massively by secretariats or by pre-cooked sort of agendas, although that does have an impact. And they come to it from very different perspectives. Several of them are in quite a bit of trouble. David Cameron, of course, maybe in the last few weeks of his prime ministership when he goes to Japan, very seriously. I mean, if Brexit goes through, it's pretty well acknowledged that he'll probably be forced to resign. It would obviously raise a very large issue for Britain's future, for the EU, but also for the global economy. I mean, the IMF's warnings and others about the real risk to the global economy of a Brexit shock, I think, is something that will be on the minds of the leaders. But there's actually very little that they can do about it, because this, you know, the die had been cast in a way by late May. I mean, the vote, I think, is on June 23rd. And so really there's very little that they can do at that stage. If the meeting was immediately after the vote, there may be a way to try to sort of limit the damage of a Brexit vote, but it's before. But I think it will be on the minds of the leaders. Angela Merkel is obviously also probably less severely, but also in trouble and under pressure because of the refugee issue, which is slightly abated in recent weeks, but is still very much a long-term sort of challenge. And there are German elections next year, there are French elections next year, and President Hollande is under pressure there. Renzi, I think, is in a slightly different category where he is a little bit less pressure. And Justin Trudeau, as I mentioned, is still in the sort of honeymoon phase, which leaves President Obama. And I think this is a this obviously trip to Japan is part of a broader thing for him. There's the whole issue around the Hiroshima visit and the broader sort of context of his trip to Japan. But I think that he will agree, I think, that the about the focus sort of on East Asia, and that there are, you know, that while we need to keep focus on these transnational issues, that he's been long on record, and that the world is sort of, that the US is over invested in the Middle East, and there needs to be more sort of global attention and US attention on the Asia Pacific. So I sense some sort of overlap between him and the Prime Minister there, even if he would obviously, I think, not push probably the maritime issue to the forefront to the same degree that Japan has. So I think I will just conclude by saying that I do think that these are very significant summits this year. I leave it to my colleagues to talk about the G20, which I'm happy to talk about in conversation. But I do think that that obviously will be focused more on these common challenges. And we may, depending on the Brexit vote and others, have real issues in the global economy that need some addressing come that meeting. But that this G7 summit, for me, just at least marks, in addition to the one that excluded Putin, although he then sort of showed up uninvited at a side event. But along with that one is really a landmark in terms of the trajectory of geopolitics toward a more competitive environment. And the question, I think, is whether or not we see anything over the next few years that can sort of pull that back more in the direction of common challenges, or whether that continues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Mireya, for inviting me. It's a great pleasure and honor being here. So I'm going to start with a bit of big picture, what the big issues are. Then I'll narrow down to 2016, risks and opportunities, and then get down to the two summits. I'll take more a position of big historical overview and liberal internationalism with some realist caution. So first, to start off, I would argue that we are living through a historic transition in the global system and human history. So the stakes are high. We're not in a period of business as usual. We're in a historical change, the kind of transitions that happen once in 100 years. So the stakes are very high. There's also a strategic window of opportunity, because we're still at a time when the dialogue between rising powers and established powers is possible, where cooperation is possible. It's also a period of rule creation, and there will be a reward for policy entrepreneurs and for those who play an active role in setting the new institutions and new rules. I think that countries that get this the most, that understand the sort of historical period where we are Singapore, possibly Korea, and Canada may be coming back to it under the current government. I should also point out that in 2016, we don't just have those two events, G7 and G20. We also could have a historically important trilateral summit between China, Japan, and Korea that's due in Japan, although there is less momentum now. But behind the conflict that I'm about to talk about between Japan and China, there is actually convergence of FTA strategies between Japan and China. Both of them want to increase the percentage of their trade covered by FTAs, which is very low. Both of them want to reach about 70%. And for both of them, they can't reach the target without including each other. And both have exactly, it comes from trade ministries, but they have come to the same conclusion. So my punchline, before I get to more details, is that by and large, however, the G7 and G20 this year operate in different spheres. They're mostly led by different ministries. And so in that sense, I agree with what Tom just said. There's very little coordination between the two hosts at the moment. And there is clearly some irritation around the South China Sea issue. Even though the two summits could end up walking in the same direction on climate and development, but without real coordination. So before getting back to the summits, I want to step back and ask what the current global challenges are, since Mireya put to us the challenge of dealing with them and then seeing how the summits can answer them. To me, the real challenge facing us and all the countries in the world is how to buttress the resilience and capacity of our global liberal economic system in the face of both a period of prosperity and interconnectivity, but also three fundamental challenges. And those three fundamental challenges, if we look at history, tell us that the global economic system that we have today could collapse, as it did in the 1930s. So I think that's, to me, the real big issue above all. Number one, we face an increase in systemic risks of growing and growing scale that include financial crisis. And there we have to deal with the tremendous complexity of preventing another crisis, but also knowing how to coordinate the response when it happens. And we should remember, great historian Kinderberger reminding us that why the 1929 crisis was so great or became so treacherous and led to the collapse of the global system. It's not because of the stock market itself. It was because the large players became unable to coordinate the response. And in particular, the UK had no more ability to deal with a crisis that big. The US was unwilling. So if we have a crisis in 5 or 10 years and we have the US and China in that kind of situation, then the crisis would not be answered in the way that it was in 2008-2009. We also face systemic risks, of course, as mentioned by Tom, around issues like climate change. And the only way to deal with climate change and not sink or not have the dire scenarios that have been given to us is by transforming our economic structure entirely by about 2050. So we have 35 years to decarbonize, which means have new technologies and do things differently. So the challenge is big. We also have to deal with pandemics, biodiversity, managing high-risk technologies, and above all, the interaction between technologies and the natural order, what the Prime Minister of Bhutan calls planet building. So we have real big issues to deal with. And that's only the first of the three challenges. The second one is adjusting to the tremendous shift in the global balance of power that we have just gone through. So this is the once-in-a-century shift. Remember that China's size of global GDP was 2% in 1990. And today, in nominal dollar, is between 13 and 14%. In PPP terms, is 19%. And that's just China. China is about half the shift. The other emerging powers also got another half of global GDP. You don't have a shift in global GDP that big without the need to adjust a lot of things, including global rules, global institutions, and the voice in those institutions. It also put geopolitical pressures, and that's where I converged with what Tom said. But in a way, when there is a shift that big, there has to be adjustment, right? We can't just hold the way we were before. Otherwise, those tensions are unmanageable. And that's the story we lived through with the rise of Germany, the rise of Japan. The system was unable to give space to that rise, and that led eventually to extreme tensions and war. And the third challenge is we are dealing with tremendous anger and sensitivity to inequality in most countries, particularly the US and Europe. So essentially, the people are angry, and the support for global governance today and globalization is going down. It's even lower for global governance than for globalization. So it's hard to coordinate and create rules to deal with those problems when actually the public doesn't support it because they lost trust in it. So those are the big issues. And behind this, therefore, one big challenge is how to build trust between emerging and established powers and integrate China in the world order. In a way, I put this as the number one issue that we face. When you have a rising power that size displacing that much, power and momentum and gravity, that is the number one issue, how to integrate them in the global rule-based order that we live in. And in a way, by giving them both voice and by getting them to stick to the rules as well. So that's the big picture. When I get to 2016, we actually face a bundle of unprecedented risks and a few opportunities. The report from the Eurasia Institute that's done every year by Ian Bremmer this year said that in the 20-plus years that they have done it, this is the year with the highest systemic risk and the highest geopolitical risks. So we have that on one hand. We also live through a period of deceleration of the economy. The IMF keeps downgrading the global economic growth. Trade is flat. We're not quite negative, but we have less trade growth than we have even in economic growth. We have essentially no more room, no more fiscal room, no more monetary room, and structural reforms are not doing very well either. So we have very few engines to dynamize the global economy. I won't say more because Colin will pick that thread, and because there's one engine that's possible with infrastructure. When it comes to social discontent, we should really not minimize the issue of the Panama Papers. It's not just the fact that that information was released. It's the fact that it's really explosive information. And in a way, the Panama Paper puts China, but also Iceland, the UK, France, the US, Malta, all on the same page. That is a sense that the game is rigged due to a mismatch between the exit options available for the wealthy and the capacities of the state to deal with them. So the average people looking at this are angry because of the sense that the game is rigged. And that sense is explosive. That's what drives revolutions. And we have the same kind of anger in China with respect to the corrupt elite as now we have toward Cameron or to Iceland. So this is very, very important. And in turn, it feeds into populism. So we have the rise of populism. We see it in the U.S. election. We see it in a lot of European countries. And remember that populism and political actions responding to social anger is what Polanyi reminded us drove the collapse eventually of the global economy in the 1930s. We know are living through one of the greatest period of migration flows. This is not going to be just about Syria. There will be more, we know, some driven by poverty, some driven by climate, some by war. We are not equipped to deal with this. We deal with state collapse, terrorism, and if we believe Ian Bremmer, the biggest thing that could happen in the next 2-3 years is the collapse of Saudi Arabia, because the model is teetering on the brink. And then we find, finally, that's where I converge with Tom, creeping securitization of the global liberal order. So instead of having the global economic integration leading to reduced tensions on the security side, right now we have a reverse causality where tensions on security are starting to affect the trust in the global economy. So the opportunities, however, is related to an amazing series of things that happened in late 2015. First, we find, finally, at the end of the term, we find real U.S. leadership, and U.S. leadership is the oxygen in the world system. Of course, the pity is that the number of things where the U.S. is leading now, when it comes to climate, SDGs, IMF reforms, etc., are issues where the leader cannot take full ownership in the public realm in the U.S. or in Congress, for that matter. So it's kind of odd leadership. It's lame duck leadership, but it still works at the moment. So the SDGs were a huge thing. COP21 was a big thing. The IMF reforms finally ratified were a big thing. And finally, there's a bit of a window of opportunity between China and the U.S. So that now leads me to a couple words on G8 and G20 in this bigger context. About the G8, it's important to know that foreign ministries dominate the agenda of the G8, whereas in the G20, the finance ministries and a few other ministries in some countries have a key role. We know the foreign ministers communiques out. There's some good work there on nuclear disarmament, some tremendous symbolism of seeing Foreign Minister Kishida and Secretary Kerry holding each other in front of the Hiroshima Monument. So that's a powerful moment. There's a lot of action on a lot of security issues. But on the maritime security, that strong declaration in support of UNCLOS, we should remember UNCLOS not ratified by the U.S. yet, does open some risks if this issue is not managed well, it will indeed affect all the other issues that I just listed. So that's the most sensitive issue. And the hope, of course, would be to find a way that uphold international law by finding a way to save face for China, although nobody has found that way yet. The two areas where there may be a bit of convergence would be climate and development, which are both on the G7 agenda. But in both cases, there is no mention at all that this is a core issue for the G20. So, for example, on climate, the sentence now in the agenda is the G7 is expected to play a leading role in the area of energy policy or in addressing climate change. On development, the G7 will need to take a proactive leadership role in carrying forward the 2030 agenda. So there is no effort at building a bridge here with the G20. Now, the note, however, is the G7 can possibly marshal resources and some funding, but any real action on climate, development, etc., requires coordination with emerging economies. So taking too much of a in-the-face kind of leadership through the G7 will actually backfire, would not help the global issues as much. When it comes to, and the sounds I hear from Canada and Europe have been indeed a little worried about where Abe is taking the summit. So it's not just the Europeans, the Canadians have also been. And indeed, they're kind of put in this difficult position because they cannot say, no, we don't respect international law, so they have to stand behind UNCLOS. They all believe in international law. But they also know that building bridges with emerging powers over global issues is what will make or break the global system. And so going in the face and destroying bridges will hurt every other issue. In addition, we live through a period of a rising power, as I mentioned, and you can't have a rise that big without giving a bit of space to the rising power. But giving that space while upholding international law is the key challenge here. Now, going too far in the face with China, however, creates what we see now, which is a tit-for-tat action-reaction game, where each step taken by the U.S. and Japan leads to a counter-step by China and more militarization of the islands. So that, I think, is not the ideal pathway, but finding a better pathway is not easy right now. The G20 is going to focus on growth, trade, development, climate, financial regulation, and tax evasion. And there is potential great progress there. I keep the rest for the Q&A, but I wanted to do a final couple points on Japan, trying to think bigger about Japan and relating conversations I had in Tokyo beyond the foreign ministry, but with other ministries, with the leaders, political leaders and economic leaders there. Japan has tremendous assets, technology, know-how, human capital, is a tremendous player in the UN system, tremendous endowments. But probably Japan would maximize its role in the global economy and the global geopolitical system if it can position itself as, you know, maneuvering between emerging powers, including China, and established powers, which then requires a realist engagement with China. Taking advantage of the current moment when new rules are being redrawn and when the future of the system is at stake requires primarily for Japan better coordination in the Kante, in the Prime Minister's office. Today, Japan suffers from fragmentation among the three core ministries. And I know, for example, that METI has much to contribute on the issue of global economy coordination that should be that ideally should have a bigger voice in the Kante and the management of both summits, but it's not happening right now. So I think Japan could do more by pulling all its forces and all its endowments together. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being here, everyone, and thanks to the organizers for actually focusing on the G7 and the G20 together, something which for the long period of 13 years that I've been working on the G20, I've been loath to do because I was 13 years ago was a replacer. I came here to Brookings in 2003 to write a book about transforming the G8 to G20 at summit level. So the G7 to G8 became an annoyance. So I'm glad you've done this because I think it's very revealing of some of the real tensions involved, and I think the discussion will be excellent. Let me just move quickly to what I have to say. The issue I'm going to start with is is the one Mariah mentioned, which is the G20 growth agenda and the long-run sustainability agenda. We just had in this very room last Wednesday a Think 20 meeting with between Brookings and several advanced country institutes, CG, Lowy, and the German Development Institute, along with three leading think tanks from China, the CAS, the Shanghai Institutes for International Studies, and Renmin University. We had a meeting of 60 people in this very room last Wednesday on the G20 China summit. And where we came out was the three top priorities as far as the think tank 20 is concerned are growth, infrastructure, and Agenda 2030. And to see these in an integrated way, and see them in an integrated way synoptically in the following way, is that the growth, there was considerable concern among the economists in the room about the vulnerabilities in the global economy. That translated into a concern about understanding the underlying fundamentals that are driving the continuing vulnerability and sluggishness of the global economy, such as the dynamics between productivity change and growth, which are negative in terms of employment creation. And nobody's quite got a handle on it. There's no silver bullet for sure. If anything, that problem itself reduces to granularity inside of specific countries, different responses in different places. But it shows that there's more to the problem than just insufficient aggregate demand, and that that one needs to simultaneously think about the long-run trends, the long-run dynamics, the long-run underlying fundamentals at the same time that you're trying to achieve growth in the short run. It was said at the outset that we've essentially exhausted monetary, fiscal, and structural adjustment policy, as Eve just told you, and it was argued that the fourth pillar for dealing now with both the short term and the long term is investment in infrastructure. And it's really a shame for more reasons than one that Nancy Alexander is not with us to discuss this, but personal issues prevail over professional ones on occasion, and unfortunately that's true in her case. So, but it's clearly true that there's an underlying need to use investment in infrastructure to spur short-term growth, which it does by increasing demand for investment goods and construction and the like, to use investment in infrastructure as the key vehicle for achieving transformational change in the way that Eve spoke of it on climate change, and to use investment in infrastructure to achieve the transformational changes that are envisioned in Agenda 2030 towards achieving sustainability by 2030 and beyond to 2050, as Eve mentioned. So investment in infrastructure becomes a key instrument. In fact, the only instrument that's left, the only arrow in the quiver, because monetary, fiscal, exchange rate policy and structural adjustment, the normal macro policy tools have been exhausted. So let me just tell you something about to make a contrast here as a way of making a point. What we decided in our meeting among predominantly economic think tanks, though not entirely, was that this agenda, growth, infrastructure, and Agenda 2030 go in that order. So now there's a danger to doing that, which Eve actually has captured in something he now calls the Vision 20. He held the first large meeting of this in the G20 summit site in Hangzhou, China, three weeks ago, to which Amar Bhattacharya from here and I had participated. And his ordering is different, I think. Or I would argue that what is the point of Vision 20 as opposed to Think 20? The point of Vision 20, founded by Eve, is to highlight the longer-term underlying structural, more political elements of managing the future than the current practice in G20s in general and regrettably in G20 summits to focus on the short term, to focus on the technical, and to focus on policy or macro policy oriented things. In other words, the discourse of leaders at summits has been swamped by the discourse of finance ministers at a different level. And I submit to you that the people don't understand exchange rates. And if the people don't understand exchange rates, talking to them about it in order to reassure markets is going way over their heads. So the reason that summits, G20 summits, are seem to have flagged since 2010 is not because the problems aren't urgent. It's that the summits have focused on the wrong problems. They're focusing, as Eva's critique basically points out, on the short term, the incremental, and the technical problems that are in the domain, really, of finance ministers, and not on the leadership issues of a people that, as Eve has pointed out, who were angry, anxious, and concerned about livelihoods, their pensions, their economic security, their social security, their pensions, and their political paralysis in many of their countries, not to speak of the planetary boundaries which are being transcended. So the failure of leaders has been simply not to articulate, that they have not articulated the vision of urgency that the future holds for the planet and for our people and for our societies, our economies, and our economic institutions if there isn't transformative change. So this puts a completely different light on the sustainable development agenda. The sustainable development agenda is a term from the 1990s that applied to developing countries. Agenda 2030 is a sustainability challenge to the world that includes, importantly and crucially, the G20 countries. Because if systemically important countries don't commit to Agenda 2030 as a domestic agenda, global sustainability will not be achieved in 2030 or in 2050 because the business as usual simply will not get us where we are going. So it's a political failure to articulate the urgency now of anticipated problems in the future if we continue on business as usual trends. That's the fact. So the question, the wonderful convergence here is that 2016 is the first year of implementing Agenda 2030, and it happens to be the China presidency in which China, I think, wishes to make a difference from Hangzhou in September, and wishes to provide, strengthen its own leadership and exercise it in relation to the global interest, rather than just asserting itself and its own national interests, because that's what the G20 summit is basically about. I mean, think about it. The advantage to internationalizing the politics of large continental-sized nations like the United States and China is to insert them into a multilateral mechanism like the G20, where you have other significant powers that you cannot ignore, civilizational powers, important cultures, irrespective of more populous than the G7, irrespective of the fact that their economies are also large. So these are countries that need, and peoples, nations, that need to be brought into the global conversation. And so by having those voices and those powers at the table in the G20, the larger continental powers like the United States and China have to behave differently in that forum. You just can't sit down and say, because we are large and massive in size, we think this, and therefore you must do this as well. This is not the political dynamic of how the G20 works. So I think China will seize this moment to try to exercise leadership, and there's evidence already. I mean, Haibing Zhang from the Shanghai Institute brought two G20 development working group papers from a meeting of the development working group in April in Nanjing to our Think 20 conference last week. One of those papers had templates of eight issues that you'd want G20 countries, major economies, to address domestic. Seven of those eight issues were domestic. The last one was about relations of advanced industrial countries with the developing world, which is the right proportions to have if you take Agenda 2030 seriously. So, and the other one was a draft of the collective action plan of the G20 to address Agenda 2030. So the indications there, that was phenomenal news as far as we were concerned. Actually, Haibing Zhang and I had written a paper a year and a half ago arguing that this is exactly the path that China should take, which is to say that without, as I said before, without the systemically important countries in the G20, Agenda 2030 means nothing. The 173 countries that are not in the G20 can do everything under the sun to reach sustainability themselves by themselves, and they will not reach it because the spillover effects and global trends are set by the G20. So without them, Agenda 2030 means nothing. So I think that this documentation is very, very encouraging, but there is still reluctance among the advanced industrial countries, I think, to take this as seriously as I'm trying to argue it should be taken with you this morning. And there is some, you know, this is just a development working group set of papers. There is a question, there has been a SherPA's meeting since, which has endorsed them and seems to be taking them forward, but there's a long way to go still to see whether China, in fact, in Hangzhou, the G20 leaders actually deal with this. So let me go to the point that's been already discussed here, is what's the relationship between the G7 and the G20 on these issues? Well, you've heard a good discussion this morning on this, and I think the way I would reflect on it, thinking about what Dean Acheson said, Tom, about you have to find situations of strength with like-minded countries. Dean Acheson was Secretary of State a long time ago. We live in a very different world. I think a better approach to geopolitical security and economic challenges, the urgent systemic challenges that we face, is to realize that there are two responses we can have to these global challenges. One is populist nationalism, which is what we're seeing now on the part of not only other countries, but the U.S. in particular. I mean, it's very interesting as you look around the world that there's a missing political center. You would have thought in a time of economic uncertainty, social fragmentation, that the center, even the progressive center-left, would have captured this anger that Eve mentioned before and that I've mentioned. What has happened is the extreme right has captured that anger. And that is a danger. So there's an alternative, which is responsible nationalism. The G20 is not an international organization. This is not international civil servants who have left their roots behind, who meet and decide the fate of the world. This is a forum of national political leaders. Even finance ministers are national political leaders. So the game is how to articulate these domestic concerns and anxieties into a global posture and policy and strategy to deal with issues which are of concern to people in a way that secures, makes them feel secure, that reassures them that that leaders understand the threats that impact on them and moves the world towards some sort of resolution of them. So it's my view that the G7, the worst thing that could happen to the G7, and I've felt this for some time, is that it become a caucus of like-minded people who kind of get their house in order before they go to the G20 summits. Stephen Harper tried that in Canada in the early part of 2010 by having the G8 summit first, and a day later the G20 summit in Toronto. The Chinese threatened not to go. The Koreans, who were holding a summit in Seoul, Korea, in the fall of 2010, were furious. It shows you that that's not the way to do business. And what you want in the G20 in any case is not blocks. You don't want the G7, you know, forming its positions and the BRICS forming theirs and having a, quote, conversation across these divides. What you want is a complex agenda in which everybody has different national interests, and therefore they align themselves differently depending on what issues on the table, so that you get what I've called for some years shifting coalitions of consensus within the G20, so that on an issue A, one set of countries will have a majority voice, and in issue B, a completely different set. So that's a much healthier dynamic because it means that you're negotiating about pragmatic, real, tangible things, and you're not dealing from allies versus enemies. You're not dealing with adversaries. You're all working together, trying to move a complex set of issues forward simultaneously. So I think the bottom line here is that the SDGs, Agenda 2030, could be an answer to the political missing middle. The SDGs, when you stop to think about it, is a people-centered agenda which anticipates the future and meets the current set of human conditions where people are angry and anxious. It addresses those two simultaneously. That's the issue to lead with in Hangzhou, in my view. That's the issue that Eve has put forward in Vision 20, as opposed to the T20, where we're still focused on the economic issues, which I think will not get us there. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the very thoughtful remarks from all of you. I think that you have already provided depth and nuance in discussing these very important topics that we frequently do not find when we talk about global summitry. So I want to just get us started with a conversation first and then bring the audience and have them ask questions. But, you know, I don't work myself on global summitry, so I have curiosity about the workings of global summitry and what can we expect. We should have realistic expectations about what these kind of forums can achieve. And it seems to me that, you know, crisis management is the hallmark, if you will, of global summitry. That's where the assets of bringing leaders to the table shine through. The idea that you can, you know, make these fast, important decisions, bring everybody on board or try to do so. But we know that the G7 and the G20 have tried to do much more than this. And I think Colin, in particular, your remarks were talking about longer-term issues and how we move from global summitry to be an immediate response, as effective as it can be in the, we're thinking of the global financial crisis, to actually providing a vision or a roadmap to how we deal with the most difficult issues ahead. So I wanted to basically ask the other panelists to respond to Colin's comments on how we think about the challenges for global summitry to address long-term issues. And to you, Colin, in particular, where we think that there is a political will in China, in Japan, to agree to this process of multilateralization, if you will. Because big countries, continental powers, powers that play in the global field, do not like to be constrained. So do you think that they're ready to do so in the context of the G7 and G20? So comments from anybody?
You guys go first.
Sure. Well, I'll start then. Firstly, I think there's a large degree of overlap between all of us, although I think there are some, you know, differences as well. I certainly agree that, you know, there are these long-term global challenges, and the G20 is an important forum to address those. And I think, you know, colonies are exactly right, that you don't want to address a lot of those directly through to the G7 because the major actors are not there. I mean, it makes very little sense to talk about you know, to try to shape the future of the global economy without, you know, China or climate change or any of these issues. I do think the problem with even the G20 is that these are not necessarily coordination difficulties, right? I mean, there are differences of philosophy about how to deal with these problems. One country we haven't mentioned, you know, Germany, which has a very different view of infrastructure investment. You know, I mean, that's really the gap between the U.S. or, you know, and Germany rather than between the U.S. and China. I mean, Schäuble is opposed to spending any money, incurring any debt on infrastructure, even if you can basically borrow that money for free. On this stage last year, he was very explicit that what worries him is the nominal levels of debt, not the debt ratios. And so that, I think, is just as a conversation ender, basically, in terms of, you know, the G whatever, because Germany is a part of all of them in terms of coordinated, you know, response. And so countries have very different, obviously China has its own sort of difficulties. There's, you know, I think more support for stimulus here accepted on the Hill. And so that's, you know, highly significant as well. And so I'm a little skeptical of the G20's capacity to deal with these, not because of any problem to do with the G20 per se, but it's just because these leaders come at different places. The only other point I'd make is that, you know, I certainly understand your frustration and you know, for the sake of argument, I'll just make it explicit, but about these other, you know, issues. But what strikes me is that, you know, both the geopolitical issues, you're both saying they shouldn't be that important, right? Like that they shouldn't be on the agenda in these places because what's really important are the long-term issues and that we need to stay focused, you know, on those. But the leaders believe they are important, and so they're putting them up there. And it isn't the case that in the South China Sea, for instance, that these are, you know, tit-for-tat issues or inadvertent escalations. I mean, these are real dynamics that are happening because of strategic decisions that certain leaders are making. And I think that's why, you know, they're rising in level. I certainly want to see the cooperation on the global issues continue, but we will need to do both. And these are going to clash to some extent, and it's just the new reality. It's not a preference. It's just saying that that's the world we're in now.
Thank you, Tom. Any comments?
So I have a few points. First, to answer Miria's first question on what the two summits, what the G summits can do, crisis management is definitely an issue. You know, and in 2008, 2009, it was the number one issue to deal with. And it worked to some extent. You know, I agree with Dresner that the system worked. You know, the leaders came together, both at home and in the G20. But that, in the long term, that's there's only one issue, and it's, in a way, it could be not the most important. The other critical issue is that, you know, if I echo what Michael Spence has written about, or Danny Roderick, or Joe Stiglitz, you know, the UN report on the global financial crisis 2009, the Stiglitz Commission, all those reports, in a way, building on institutional economics, have shown that you can't have global markets that are functioning without global rules and global institutions. If you keep extending markets without having rules keeping pace with the markets, then you have a mismatch between the institutionalization and the global markets. And over time, we know that this creates uncertainty, lower trust, and volatility, and eventually can lead to collapse of markets. We know that we need to adjust the institutions. We need to expand the capacity where there are gaps. And for that, the only way is for the large countries, you know, given the system that we live in, for the large countries to agree on the roadmap and then instruct the right working groups and the right institutions to do it. And so that agenda of institution building, I think, is more fundamental, you know, except when you have a crisis as big as 2008, than the technical adjustments and the year-to-year adjustment to small crises. And so that's the G20. Where I agree with Tom is the G20 is not done. It's not done enough. The leaders often don't have the will to really face those issues fully. At the same time, it's the only thing we have because that's the only group that allows for, in a way, a good-natured or a good chance as a dialogue between the large emerging powers and established powers in doing this institutional job. So that's why it's so crucial. In terms of leadership, the question on leadership, I would see, you know, one element which I find could have been easy and cheap, but maybe is a miss, is just as Japan is inviting to the G7 all the major economic institutions, including World Bank and ADB. So the ADB, not just global like IMF, World Bank, they also invite the ADB to the summit. They should have invited the AIIB and the NDB in the spirit of the agreement of September 25 between China and the U.S., in which there's an effort for all the MDBs to work together. So having the MDBs in Asia work together toward common, common norms, common good governance, etc., is what we need to do. And so leaving one group out and refusing to accept them at this point is not wise, and it doesn't show leadership. On the South China Sea, my point is simply, it is very important, it has to be addressed, but my point would be that we have to do scenarios in a way. We have to say, how do we get to a better outcome, right? What are the different options? And to do that, we first have to unpack what the issue is. And the issue is essentially a story of domestic politics in China and domestic coalition, as Xi Jinping is gearing up for reform and has taken on so many groups in the anti-corruption, including the military leadership, the security leadership, some large vested interests. He has chosen, apparently, to give big space to the military on the South China Sea. And the South China Sea may have even splurged in overbuilding those islands beyond, I'm not sure what the authorization was initially. The problem is, once he has gone this far and building up on a nine-dash line that's inherited from the Republic of China, so that's a long history. The nine-dash line for China predates UNCLOS, right? Because it was from the Republic of China time. But it doesn't, we know from our perspective that it doesn't work with UNCLOS, right? It's in opposition to UNCLOS in some ways. But we have to think through of a way to unpack that domestically in a way that Xi Jinping doesn't have an enormous cost and therefore is unable to unpack it. So all I'm calling for is a very realistic analysis of options. And probably my hunch is that it should be done at the diplomatic level or in low-key separate meetings. And it should include a bundle of tough talk on international law and some creative thinking. But putting it at the center of G7, I don't think will yield great outcomes and will not support a G20 for sure.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief. I mean, I think the answer I basically mm-hmm. would give is, by the way, Tom, I mean, I'm very much in favor of geopolitics being part of G20 summitry. There, I think Bruce has written an article just mm-hmm. in the last week. And, you know, the great example actually was in St. Petersburg, where there was a dinner scheduled at 8:30 on the one evening that leaders were spending together. It was going to be on development. And it was the time when the chemical weapons, the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime in Syria was on. The leaders went in the room alone, which is the best thing about the dinners. That behavior, the G20 would do well to mimic the G7 by focusing on the informality of leaders, as you both mentioned, is they went in the room at 8:30 at night and they came out at 2:30 in the morning. And, nobody's too sure what went on, but what went on was communication, pretty intense communication among the leaders of the most important, largest economies in the world. And that's the kind of thing that needs to happen. So my main answer to the skepticism, the understandable skepticism, the realistic constraints on, continental powers and others in summits is it really, I don't mean to sound flip, but it's really a question of behaving as adults. And, the example that Eve gave of the Japanese not inviting the AIIB to, the outreach session of the G7 summit is a good example. That's, we've got to be willing. What I was getting at before is you don't want to be, I've said for years that you want to be in the room with the people with whom you have the biggest disagreements. Then you really have something to talk about. I mean, but you have to be willing to do, as you said, is to be able to figure out where the space is domestically for your adversary, if you want to think of the country in that term, so that they can accept an outcome which is globally suitable. And, that's adult behavior. I mean, no marriage exists in this world today without that kind of give and take. There's lots of reasons why men and women have fundamental disagreements and things like this. So
It's really a question of growing up and realizing that the neighborhood boundaries have shifted from, you know, your city or village to your nation to the world, and that we've got to engage. And it's fun, furthermore. The more difficult it is, I find it the more challenging. And so I think the style that we bring to it, this is why I'm thinking Justin Trudeau's, you know, entrance into this game, and there are some others. There are eight of the G20 leaders, 19 leaders that have been elected in the last 2 years. So there's a fresh bunch of faces that they can bring something different. You know, leaders in the room, let them play it out themselves. Let them come up with the conclusion themselves. Gordon Brown ripped up the communique that was the leaders' communique that was drafted by the staff in April of 2009. They did some drafting, but they did drafting based on the leaders' conversation, not on the staff preparations. That's the way to do it.
Great. So I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to restrain myself because I want the audience, to have a chance to ask questions. Just a brief comment on, you know, everybody has remarked on the South China Sea and the disruptive effect of that communique that came out last week from the foreign ministers' meeting of the G7. Just a point of correction of the record, didn't the German G7 summit also produce a similar document? So it's not a new issue, right? It has come up in previous G7s, and it has had the effect it had differently this time, I think, because obviously the meeting took place in Hiroshima. So just want to point that out.
That's a good point. Except it's a separate declaration in this case, right? It's actually not in a communique, it's its own document.
I see. So the standalone document. Okay.
Elevated.
So we're in that tit for tat. We can see very clearly. All right. I will ask you to please identify yourselves. Be very concise because time is short. There's so many questions and issues on the table. So I'll wait for the microphone and I'll take two questions at a time. So please do very, very concise. So Chris and then Yamakoshi-san, I promise Philip, you'll go next.
Thanks so much. Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. I try to write about this stuff every day, but you guys have just opened up an entirely new universe for people like me who deal with it every day because we have our nose up against the glass. And the biggest problem I have is when I'm dealing with people who do the trade stuff and they tell me about the IPR theft and how Microsoft lost, you know, $300 billion, you know, whatever it was last week. Or I talk to the Filipinos, where'd your fishing grounds go, is I can't find myself to trust anything the Chinese tell me about anything in the long range because I look at what they're doing in the short range and they're not keeping any of the rules they've said they made. How is that just me or do we all have to struggle with that every day? And how can we deal with that kind of thing, these short-term mistrust issues that block any really intelligent discussion of this stuff? You guys, I've got two grandkids now, so 2050 suddenly is real to me. I was going to be dead before. No, I'm not going to be dead before. I've got grandkids. So how do we get over this immediate level of mistrust and talk like adults?
Great. Very good. Yamakoshi-san, and if we can keep it concise so that.
My name is Atsushi Yamakoshi. I'm from Keidan, USA. I have a question to Ibu-san because I think you are a Japanese specialist. There are so many global and domestic challenges for G7 and G20, but I think the economic situation affects very much those challenges, and particularly for Japan, in order to implement leadership and chairmanship, I think the recovery of Japanese economy is very important. So I'd like to get your kind of perspective, you know, how we can get our economy recovered. We are struggling for that every day, but still we need some, you know, input from foreign observers, how we can, you know, revitalize Japanese economy. And in that context, I'd like to get one comment about the increase of consumption tax. Yes or no? Postponing yes or no, please. Thank you.
All right. So mistrust of China and Japan's economic comeback.
Yeah. Two very different questions to different parts of my life, right? So I could try. I mean, the mistrust, we can all jump in. It is definitely a big issue you hear from many, many players.
And so what it is there's a spectrum of behavior from on the Chinese side, right? So I think to be, if we think as a social scientist, right, you will have points where you have behavior that inspires trust, and you have also behavior that inspires mistrust. You have a whole spectrum. On the trust side, you find, by and large, for example, when I track the mutual assessment process and the commitments taken by China, say in Cabo, so in Khan, et cetera, on what they do with the capital account, with exchange rate, et cetera, you come back and you find actually a high-level implementation. So when you talk to sherpas or treasury officials from other countries, and I've had some good debriefings with some other countries like Europeans, they usually give very high marks for those officials and the follow-up policies when it comes to central bank, Ministry of Finance, et cetera. In general, also, even on IPR, the laws passed by China are very good. And in fact, there has been also now a reform after the fourth plenum. Reform of rule of law includes the creation of an IPR court. And we have cases where foreign companies have won cases against local governments, provincial governments, et cetera, or SOEs, right? So we find, so those are the positive signs. In general, it's the central, there's even an epistemic community in some ways. The treasury officials and People's Bank officials understand each other well, and there's good follow-up. There's trust building at that level. Where there's mistrust, of course, is when it gets to military, right? That's where, so that we have parallel actions. Then you get to implementation, and that's where there are problems, right? First, when you get to IPR, well, you have to go down to provincial levels, then you have to go down to local level, and you have lots of bad apples, because when you are a bit in a far west environment, you have lots of private players or even SOEs sometimes who are trying to take advantage of the system. And the court system in some provinces will not be as good, or there'll be slow implementation, there'll be Guangxi issues. And so there's a lot of cases of implementation. When it comes to the seas, you do find pretty terrible behavior by some individual fishing boats, by some individual, there's been a big report in, Washington Post or New York Times on some fishing boats destroying entire atolls in the Pacific Ocean. And in general, they do it without being watched by anyone, right? So when you go back to the Chinese side, well, they say that's an issue of implementation. But in some ways, the Chinese central authorities are willing to, increasingly, they realize that those behaviors have a bad outcome for the Chinese soft powers, Chinese reputation, and there's willingness to work with the other countries in finding ways to stop it. But there's a long way to go, long learning curve, and so there's a lot of bad behavior out there. A case I've studied in detail is in Myanmar. And in Myanmar, you have two sorts of anger at Chinese players on the ground. One is because of big deals on dams and other things that were done directly with the military, and they never thought of, that the people would not like it. And so they ignored local communities and all this. So that there is a big learning curve. But the other aspect is all the border areas. And in the border areas, a lot of Chinese illegal loggers, lots of bad apples, so bad dudes, as Trump would say, coming across the border. And the Chinese authorities have not yet found a way to work with other countries in stopping and restraining this. Maybe they're slow at getting at this, but there's a huge demand. And maybe over time there'll be a learning process. So it's going to be a long, messy process, right? But trust is in the middle of this, depending who you have encountered. And when it comes to Yamakushi-san's question, I've done an entire book on structural reforms in Japan, and we know that this is a struggle since 92, 93 in Japan, finding growth. And Abenomics was the latest effort at finding a creative approach. It did give some traction. But right now we find that we are in a period where the first arrow is less than less traction. Inflation is not picking up. The exchange, now the yen is even going up, which is a surprise. And then the fiscal side, there has never been enough traction. And then we're really bumping into fiscal limits. So, it's a question of you have to build up those fiscal resources. Otherwise, you can't have 300% debt over GDP at some point. And the structural reforms have not gone far enough. So it's a long struggle. My intuition when I go to Japan is you do find that young people, when I teach young people at Todai, et cetera, don't live yet in a realm of possibilities. They feel constrained. They don't feel that they can unleash entrepreneurial spirit. So even though structural reform has a bad name, in a sense, still there is a huge amount of things that have to be done when it comes to education, when it comes to higher education, when it comes to labor market, and when it comes to supporting the entrepreneurial spirit and the creation of companies. So that's where there's a lot of space. When it gets to consumption tax, over time it's necessary. There's no way around it. And it's clear, when you can't go up at 40 to 45% expense over GDP and resources at 30% of GDP. By the way, it's the same in the U.S., right? And by OECD standards, both for Japan and the U.S., it's a revenue problem. Because in the OECD, everyone else's expenses that is 40 to 60% is higher, but they have revenues to match that. So at some point, there's a revenue problem in Japan. There's no question about it. But it's all about timing afterwards, right? So when you are in a phase of deceleration, you may need to postpone by another year, but it gets messy, right? But by the way, calling an election for this is tactically or politically clever, but it's really unnecessary by any outside standard, even though it may yet happen in the summer, right? I haven't seen yet. So in the end, more innovation on the structural side, and above all, unleashing, you know, that free spirit of, you know, especially beginning with young people is probably where growth has to be found.
Great. Do the other panelists want to put a comment?
I can wait.
Yeah, I mean, just quickly. Mm-hmm. I think the trick in this is to realize that this kind of conflict creates pushback. Let me give you an example. Is when Obama mentioned in his State of the Union speech this year, the one time he mentioned China, he said, he argued for TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. TPP. And he said, if we don't do it, if we don't write the rules the Chinese will. Well, I've been to China twice since that speech, and I've brought it up every time with Chinese. They've all remembered it, of course. And what you have to realize is and yet they are cooperating. I mean, look at the nuclear summit that just took place here. I mean, clearly Obama, Xi Jinping has decided that given the alternative landscape that's developing in the United States, Obama looks like a pretty good guy to deal with, and let's try to lock some stuff up before he leaves. And so what is Obama doing? Obama's creating space for himself when he's talking to the American public, even though he knows, of course, the Chinese are listening. He's creating space by standing firm against China on a competitiveness level in order to be able to cooperate on the nuclear level or on some other things. And so the same thing applies to the Chinese. And so I think it's just a question of getting intensively enough engaged between Americans and Chinese, between Europeans and Chinese, and others, so that we all understand exactly the games that we're playing and that we have to play in order to, you have to pay attention to the domestic political base.
All right. There's a lot of interest in the room. So can we do a lightning round, one phrase question, one phrase answer? Because otherwise we'll never get out of here. And I think it's a sign of how interesting this is, but I want to get everybody out of the room on time. So one phrase questions. Philippe?
Okay, it's going to be hard, but I'm Philippe Lecour from Brookings. Colin, you mentioned that people are angry in many countries, and you didn't go very specifically about it. But I was wondering, and you mentioned China last week, the Chinese think tanks putting together some proposals. How much do you think China is prepared to open its own situation to the G20 and especially the social problems that may be in China, and how much is it ready to share and you know, discuss with other countries its own domestic situation? And I don't know do you follow what I'm saying?
Thank you. That was great. I have three hands and we'll stop there. These three gentlemen right next to each other, cluster of questions.
Thanks. My name is Kakumi Kobayashi with the Kyodo News of Japan, and I would like to just make a follow-up question in terms of the crisis management capacity in the G7 in the face of the North Korean nuclear and the missile developments. So do you think expected G7 leaders can present anything more powerful and convincing than simply saying something in their statement and communique in the next session meeting? Thank you.
Thank you, Ash. And if you can just pass it to your next to you. Thank you.
Calvin Cheng. I'm not affiliated with any organization at the moment. My question is pretty brief. Can China and Japan be friends? If so, how can we get to that point? Because obviously that relationship is going to be very important for the geopolitics in Asia and globally as a whole.
Thank you, Calvin. And there was one more, I think. In the back.
So one of the things that the G20 accomplished was financial stability and the Financial Stability Forum. My question is, in light of the living well situation here, where they didn't approve the resolution authority of the banks, how does the G20 address greater accountability on the part of global financial institutions towards their sort of responsibilities? So it's more at Colin, but, and you know, everybody else.
All right. I'm going to be terribly unfair and ask you for very short answers because we're almost out of time. So maybe we, Tom, would you like to start?
Sure. Most of the questions are directed to the others, so I'll leave it. I'll just comment on one thing on what Chris said, actually, about, you know, the mistrust and trying to, how do you get people to behave like adults? I mean, I think the problem here is that we need to remind ourselves that the countries see things, you know, very differently, and there are real differences of interest, and more differences of interest now than for some time. I mean, you talk about putting these issues on the agenda. There is no way China would allow the maritime issues on the G20 agenda. Mm-hmm. We know that. They don't even allow them really on more multilateral agenda items in the region. And so I think we need to be fair in terms of, you know, which countries are behaving in the, you know, the appropriate manner. I do think one sort of just point on the general G20 stuff. I mean, there was the issue that they're really going to face is this delegitimization of the international economic order. And the big question is, can the major powers of the world change course in a way that will increase popular support for an open global economy? And there are a number of ideas. Larry Summers had an op-ed the other day about how you might do this and sort of flip the script on it. But I think that's sort of that we didn't really talk about it that much. But I think that's the long-term challenge. And actually, it's one that all of the major nations have in common because they're all facing, both of you mentioned this, these domestic issues. All countries have their domestic issues, and it's eroding support for economic sort of engagement internationally.
Thank you. Very briefly, if you don't mind.
So I'll start by saying I fully agree with Tom on this point. And the difficulty is there is one set of things that can be done at a global level, and it's addressing things like Panama Papers and financial institutions. So there has to be so much more on tax-based erosion and very, very strong action on tax havens. So that's one thing where the public will be watching very, very carefully, sense of fairness. But the rest is actually more domestic-level policies, because globalization only works when it's mediated by the right set of policies that would spread the fruits. So that's where a lot of the action is, and then it's back domestic. But if domestic systems don't do it, then it erodes support for the global system. On the North Korea question, it's a tough one, because even China, you know, the good thing is that China joined recently the condemnation at the UN, which is always a back and forth tug of war, and they have the most leeway, and they start indeed cutting even oil shipments and other things. But even they have lost much leverage over North Korea. Kim Jong-un is in a very, very difficult space, you know, reacting to no signal from outside. The more you press him, the more it doubles down. So it's really hard to find how. I mean, there will be a good statement for the G7. Everyone is in unity. In fact, even China could join most of it. But it's not biting. It's not changing behavior of Kim Jong-un, and nobody has found yet what to do. I'll just pick the China-Japan thing. There's good news behind is that while there is all this conflict up and down, actually there's always an undercurrent of pragmatic cooperation below. And when I meet METI or trade officials on both sides, actually they keep working. And they're still working on the FTA, the trilateral FTA. Tourism from China is the highest ever in Japan, right? It's been booming over the last 2 years. Of course, investment has dropped down from Japan to China. But so there's that undercurrent, and there is the understanding that they have to get together on trade. So maybe once if we could push aside South China Sea, then they will go back and cooperate.
All right. Colin, last comment?
Yes. In response to your question, it's a good one. I guess this is a kind of personal answer, but I hope it's a politically strategic answer that others can adopt. Is I have reasons in my past, having lived in Chile, why human rights is very important to me. And but I figure professionally in my discussions with the Chinese that the last thing I should do or we should do in our foreign policy right now is to put human rights and democracy and issues of this sort into the conversation as a kind of frontal piece. I think what we need to do is front the stuff that we can cooperate on, that we can agree on. We get to know each other in the process of doing this massively across the board in every sector of society. I keep telling every young family I talk to, get your kids to learn Chinese. This is the biggest thing for the future is China's relations with the world. So we have to bring it along. We have to go with the things that we can cooperate on first and do the... Well, let me stop. You get the drift of where I'm going. We can talk afterwards, actually. It's a difficult subject. And it certainly one can disagree with this position, but I think that's the adult way to move forward is really the way I would put it. So on the question of the financial stuff, I mean, I think in a way... Eve answered that is that it essentially becomes is our domestic financial regulatory reforms in front of big banks sufficient, and it's peer pressure there. You can't always count on it to work, but it's what we've got. And the FSB is better than what the FSF that preceded it. The IMF is doing a lot better itself, and in cooperation with the FSB. And it really has to do with whether other countries are willing to come to the table, big or powers and middle powers, and pressure each other to make sure the standards are good enough to hold the system together.
Great. And with this, we conclude. Thank you so much. Thank you for a wonderful, really dynamic discussion. Thank you.